Welcome back, our fellow patriots, to the Patriot Lessons American History and Civics podcast. Before we plunge into our episode, I want to thank you again for your amazing patience in waiting for this episode's release. Yes, I am still running for higher office. That is the Michigan Court of Appeals, and since I draft the script and narrate a portion of the episodes, my campaign continues to bog down our podcast. Please accept my deep apology. Today, we have a special episode in a completely different format. As part of Patriot Week, the Patriot Week Foundation engaged amazing reenactor Bob Gleason to come visit some Michigan schools as Abraham Lincoln. I had the special treat to watch one of the performances, and he was fabulous. It's a long story, but when his rental car broke down, I helped procure a new ride, and he got to visit my dog, Dickens. Dickens loves Abraham Lincoln. At the end of the day, a very grueling, tumultuous day, Bob Gleason was gracious enough to allow me to interview Mr. Lincoln in his hotel room. As this environment was not quite what we're used to, please bear with the audio quality. Before we hear from Mr. Lincoln, I want to thank Spectacular Sheila Guerin and Enchanting Aaron Marcino for all your support. And now, my interview with President Abraham Lincoln. Mr. Lincoln, we are so pleased you're able to join us today. It is awesome to be in your presence. You've been a monumental leader in American history as well as world history. But I think our listeners would like to know a little bit about your background before we embark on your political significance. So if you could, please tell us a little bit about your childhood and your upbringing.
Well, my childhood and upbringing can be described in Gray's Elegy as the short and simple annals of the poor. My people were poor, and so was everybody else we knew. I was born in Kentucky. My father moved us to Indiana to get more opportunities. He wanted to get out of a slave state and into a free state, and also one that had been properly surveyed by the government, which Kentucky was not. And people were always losing their farms to people who had less moral fiber than they did. So we moved to Indiana and had to carve our farm out of the wilderness, out of the forest. And there I grew up, going to school every now and then, but mostly working. A farm is hard work all year long, so I learned to work hard. My father taught me to work, but he never taught me to like it.
It's my understanding that you were quite the axe man. You were very muscular and was able to do some amazing feats of strength. Is that true or is that myth?
Oh, no, that's mostly true. My father handed me an axe when I was 6 years old and put me to work helping to clear the farmland. You had to get all the trees off of it first before you could plant anything. So from the next 20 years, I handled that most useful of instruments. And doing that kind of work, that builds you up. So I became not only quite tall, but quite strong as well. I could, we were trying to move a chicken house on the property from one corner to another, and they were fussing with it and fighting with it. And finally, I just wrapped my arms around it, picked it up, and carried it to the other side of the barnyard. So, I've developed quite a lot of muscular strength. I can still, at my age, hold a double-headed axe straight out from my shoulder by the very tip end of the handle without dropping it. And very few people can claim to be able to do that. I showed them on the riverboat when we met with General Grant and General Sherman, and neither of them could do it. And then they got the biggest steam fitter out of the engine room to try it, and he couldn't do it either. So it's something you develop with a lot of hard work.
Well, that's quite amazing. I understand that you were very close to your mother, and she passed away when you were pretty young. How did that affect your life?
Well, I thought that was going to ruin my life entirely. The woman who loved me and cared for me and took care of me and my sister, it was suddenly gone. She had contracted what they called the milk sickness, which we found out eventually you get from drinking the milk of cows who had been eating the snake root plant out in the woods. The cows would wander around anywhere they wanted to go and eat whatever they liked. I once watched one eat poison ivy off of a split rail fence. But the snake root is quite poisonous, and before the cow comes down with it, you've already eaten the milk, and that's what happened to my mother. It's a terrible disease that resulted in a slow wasting away of the flesh. She died hard. It was awful hard on all of us.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear that. It's amazing that you were able to overcome that tragedy in your life to become such a fine character, as well as a fine political leader. After her death, what was the course of your life? How did you become educated? And since you were in the woods, basically chopping down stuff with your axe, how did eventually you become a lawyer? There must be an interesting story there.
As to my education and success, I owe that mostly to my stepmother, Sarah Bush Johnston. My father went back to Kentucky to a court after my mother died, and he couldn't care for us as much as he'd like to. So she came and took over the job of being mother to us. She brought clothes and furniture and a lot of things we didn't have. And she encouraged me to read when my father was not in favor of my reading. She encouraged me to go to school and let me practice my lessons. She always believed in me and never doubted that I would be able to make something of myself. And I was very proud that she knew that I'd become a lawyer and gone to Congress and even was elected president. I saw her before I left for Washington, and she couldn't have been prouder of me, and I couldn't have loved her more.
How did you get involved in politics?
Well, I was at the time a very young man living in a very little town called New Salem in Illinois, trying to figure out what I was supposed to be doing with my life, as most young people do. And I was one of the few people in the neighborhood who could actually read and write. And so I would help the folks write their letters to faraway friends or relatives. I would read the newspapers to folks on a Saturday evening and otherwise help out as much as my limited education would permit. And this impressed them no end. And finally, they recommended that I run for state legislature so I would be able to represent them in the legislature and get some improvements for Sangamon and the neighborhood and see that they got what was their due. So that's when I began to be a politician. I campaigned, and eventually I was elected to the legislature 4 times. And from that, I began my studies as a lawyer and was well on my way to being the public figure I admired in other public figures and the kind of thing I wanted to be myself, but my education was holding me back. So I studied on my own to become a lawyer, and I'm quite proud of the success I've had in that line of work.
My understanding is you're an excellent lawyer, and you would go around on what we would call the circuit with judges and other lawyers, and sometimes you would end up sleeping in the same bed as your opponents or the judges that you were adjudicating cases with on a daily basis. Is that right?
Well, that's the way it was back in those days. The little towns, they didn't have their own courthouse and all that went with it, so the court would come to them, half a dozen lawyers or so, and a judge, usually Judge Davis. Now, we would find ourselves in rustic taverns in very many places with only maybe 2 beds in a room, and we'd have to crowd ourselves into those. We were usually so exhausted it didn't matter. We just fell asleep right away. Now, Judge Davis, he weighed about 300 pounds, so he always got his own bed. But that's the benefit to being the judge, I guess, and also weighing 300 pounds.
I don't even want to think about what that room looked like. So my next question is you kind of did it backwards. Often people become lawyers and then politicians or legislative leaders. You were a legislator, then became a lawyer. But then you left that profession to re-enter politics in Congress. Can you explain how that worked?
At a specific point in time, when we were moved to the new capital of Illinois, Springfield, the prominent lawyers in town would take turns serving in Congress. They'd serve for a term, and then the next fella in line, he'd stand for election and was pretty sure to get appointed. And that's how it came to me. It was my turn to run for Congress, so I did, and with the support of all the other fellas, I was elected, did my term, served my years, and then collected my family and moved back to Springfield and let the next fellow in line. So that's the sum of my congressional experience to date.
And you also ran for U.S. Senate in a very famous election. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that was the election of 1858. And I decided that the most effective way for me to get my agendas done, to make a difference in the world, was to be in the Senate, where you could propose laws and move the agendas along for your party and such. So I signed up and stood for the Senate, and my opponent was Stephen Douglas, who was quite famous by then. He was a judge and had been to Congress and knew everybody. And I challenged him to a series of debates so that we could both air our platforms, our ideas, what we planned to do. So we picked 8 towns throughout Illinois, and we put announcements in the newspaper telling what we planned to do. And then we had these debates, and they were quite popular. People back then, well, they didn't have much else to do, so they'd come to anything that was looked like it would be interesting. We had audiences in the thousands come to these debates. I would speak first, or the judge would speak first, depending on who won the toss. And then we would get a chance to argue against his position, and then he'd get a chance to rebut my rebuttals of his position, and that's how they went normally. But they attracted quite a lot of attention and were actually printed in the newspapers. There'd be reporters there taking down everything we said in shorthand, and it would turn up in the newspapers even back east. So that kind of raised my, I guess, what they call political profile now, back then. And then we had the election in time, and I got the plurality of the votes. But in those days, the senators were elected by the legislature in what they call an electoral college. And Mr. Douglas had more support in that body than I did. So although I won the most votes, I did not win the seat in the Senate. So that sort of thing needs to be addressed before something really terrible happens.
So explain this to the listeners. You had a series of debates that were very popular with the general public that came out to see you as entertainment or for education or whatever it might be. And I've read those debates. They are superb, and I recommend all of our listeners to listen to that. But why would you do that if the people that voted were the state legislature?
Well, to do that was to gain a reputation, for one thing, that I could hold my own against this very famous politician and judge, that I would get my views and the views of our new party out before the people, and hopefully influence enough of them that they in turn would influence their representatives in the legislature to vote for me. And, well, I almost did it. They voted for me, but the people voted, but not the legislature.
That was a very clever strategy, and it certainly made you a national figure at that point. So you lost, and yet somehow, and you never won another elected position until president.
Yep.
So how did that happen? That seems like a very awkward way.
Well, yeah, when we got the results of the election, somebody asked me how I felt, and I said, well, I'm too big to cry, but it hurts too much to laugh. And I went back to my law practice, but my colleagues, my friends in politics and in the law, they were looking for somebody to stand for president for our new party against, well, they assumed it would be Stephen Douglas, because that's the way his little engine was running. And they thought of all of our people in Illinois, I had the most chance. I was becoming more popularly known back east because of these debates, that they all felt that I had the best approach to politics, that they knew I was honest and fair and would do the right thing and work hard for them. So they thought, well, they'd try it out. And they went to the convention in Chicago. I didn't go. I didn't have to go. And they arranged for everything, for the tumult and the shouting, as they call it, and the votes and the ballots. And it took a while, though. There were quite a few other fellas running for the office, for the nomination. But they outlasted all those other fellas and were louder than everybody else. And so finally, I gained enough support to win the nomination. And then my troubles began.
So you won the nomination for the Republican Party. You mentioned earlier, just to go back a little bit, that you were with a new party. That was the Republican Party.
Yes, the new Republican Party.
Before that, you were...
I was a Whig. That's an old-fashioned party. It goes all the way back to before General Jackson, really. And it was just what they called the party. And it had kind of lost its sense of direction somehow. There were too many influences pulling which way. They couldn't make up their minds what they were really in favor of. So we decided we need a new party for the younger people coming up and that would stand for justice and for freedom, for abolition, among other things. So that's where that started out in 56. They ran John C. Fremont for president, but they lost. And they thought, well, we'll get somebody even better than Fremont and go at it again, which they did. There were came in on top of some very capable people like Samuel Chase and Mr. Seward of New York and quite a few gentlemen who thought they would make a good president. So a lot of the fellas wound up in my cabinet because I knew they were good at what they do, and I always try to find people who can do the job and then give them the job to do.
Some people have called that a team of rivals.
I've heard that term.
Yes.
Yes, at the time, Mr. Seward, he figured that he had the most experience, so in his mind, I would be just the figurehead president and sign the papers, and he'd run everything from behind the scenes. But I told him, no, I'm going to be the master here, and I expect you to do the job of the Secretary of State, and everyone else will do their jobs, and we'll get through this mess that we got ourselves into.
And what was that mess? When you were elected in 1860, what was the state of the country, and how did your election either help or undermine the Union?
Well, the big question of the day was the question of slavery. What to do about it, how to get rid of it if possible. Of course, the other opposition parties, they wanted to make sure not only would it continue, but it could be used to spread throughout the rest of the new territories. They would make all the new states slave states and make even more money. So that was our concern, that it was going to grow and spread like a disease. And we were trying to find a logical, legal, effective, mutually agreeable way to put an end to this awful scourge before it swallowed us whole. So that was our part of our platform, I guess they call them now, that we were in favor of what was good for the country and we were against what was not good for the country. But that sent a signal south that, oh, I was going to become president, raise an army, and march down there and free the slaves and ruin their economy, which was not my plan exactly. I had more legal ways of solving the problem. But that they didn't care to hear. No sooner was I elected than the individual southern states began to secede from the Union, even though it was illegal by the Constitution. And by the time I was finally inaugurated in March of the next year, 11 of the states had already decided that they were going to start their own country, which was against the law by the Constitution, but they weren't listening to reason. So in my first inaugural, I called upon them to remember their history and sacrifices that our forefathers made to found this country in the first place against enormous odds, and tried to find some mutually agreeable way to solve our problems rather than war, which doesn't do anybody any good. But it didn't seem to have an effect, because not more than a month after I gave the speech, they fired upon Fort Sumter and the war came.
How did you leave the country? No. How did you lead the country in such difficult times?
Well, I had to learn, really, how to lead a large country. I had never had that big a job before. I had to find the right people for all of the numerous jobs all through the country. Every little town had a postmaster that had to be either kept in place or replaced by somebody else. There were all sorts of federal jobs in every big city along the coast. It would fill a very big book, which is what I had to do. I felt sometimes while I was trying to figure out who to give jobs to that I was like a landlord who was so busy renting out rooms in the front of the house that he didn't have time to put out a fire that started in the back of the house. So I was learning on the job and learning as fast as I could. We realized that most of the really competent generals who'd been to West Point and had experience in the Mexican War were all from the South. They supported their new country and were quite capable leaders of men. And we had a very hard time finding someone with equal talent to lead our very considerable army. We had the greatest number of men. We had all the supplies that any industrial nation like our northern cities could provide for them, but we didn't have anybody who could make them into an army. You can't just get a bundle of fellas and put them out in a square and say, you're now an army, let's go fight. There's all sorts of important things a soldier has to learn. We found somebody who could build an army, that was General McClellan, but he had the slows, we called it. It was as if he didn't want to get his army dirty. So he was very reluctant to actually get out there and engage the enemy. And when he did, Robert E. Lee generally beat him. So we went through one general after another as the war dragged on until we heard about this fellow who had very prominent victories out west, and his name was Ulysses S. Grant. And I appointed him to replace McClellan and everybody else who was in line ahead of him, and he knew how to do the job and how we began to gain an advantage in the war. Grant knew how to win battles.
When the war started, most people seem to think, if I know this correctly, that it would be a short war, that there would be one or two battles, everybody would go home. Seems like both the South and the North thought that was true.
Well, yes, they figured, well, the South, they had their men from West Point, and most of them were good horsemen and would be great in the cavalry, and the others were diehard defenders and riflemen, and they thought, well, this won't take any time at all. The minute we attack, those Yankees are going to scatter in all directions, and we'll just roll right into Washington, which is pretty much what happened at the first Battle of Manassas or Bull Run. Our troops were routed. Fortunately, the Confederates did not follow up the victory and march into Washington. But that was an example of the fact that our troops weren't trained. We had offered the job as commander-in-chief to Robert E. Lee, whom General Winfield Scott once said we should insure for $6 million. He is that good. And we offered him the job, but he could not, he said, raise his sword against his country, Virginia, which is how people used to think of the individual states. Jefferson always called it his country, Virginia. They had this idea that they were like the European countries, all separate states and countries. So he couldn't see himself going down to his country, Virginia, and fighting his neighbors and colleagues. So he turned down the job, which must have been difficult for him, because he'd been in the army for 30 years, and all he really wanted was to have a field command, but spent most of his time being an engineer and fixing things. And here was an opportunity to lead what was going to be the greatest army in the world, with all the supplies you would ever need, all of the weapons you could ever use, and a constant supply of men. But he turned all that down. I think, had he been in charge of that army, the war wouldn't have lasted more than 6 months, because of his talent for leading men. He'd have gone down, captured Richmond, the war would have been over, they'd have sued for peace, there would have been no Emancipation Proclamation, no 13th Amendment, things would have gone back pretty much to the way they were before it started. And it could have been, but it wasn't. He worked for the other side.
And just to clarify, because we've covered so much ground, I want to go back a little bit. At one point, you gave a speech, the House Divided speech.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that was given before the Douglas debates, when I was, again, promoting the new Republican Party. And I got up and quoted from the Bible that a house divided against itself, meaning our country, cannot stand. I don't expect the Union to fall. I don't expect the House to fall. But I do expect that it will cease to be two things. It will be all one thing or all the other. And that upset a lot of my colleagues. That's not a good thing to say in these times. But it was what they needed to hear, that if we keep this up, there's going to be a split and a collapse. So I tell the truth, as I always found was the safest thing to do.
And your prediction came true?
I'm afraid it did.
The Civil War was America's bloodiest conflict. Mm-hmm. That must have really weighed on you.
Well, yes, I've always been, they always, when I was a young man, they called me out, out for being too kind-hearted. That somebody once said that Lincoln has the heart of a girl. He's just too soft on people. But I felt, what kind of world is it if all we do is fight and argue and cause trouble? Let's, as Mr. William Penn once said, let's see what love can do in this world. So that's, I describe it as I'm the kind of fella who will pull out a thorn and plant a flower where I think a flower might grow. They once asked me, what do you do about that man? He's your avowed enemy. I said, well, I'm going to destroy him. I'm going to make him my friend. And that's usually what I was able to do. So that was my approach, is to bring people together, not split them apart. But they just didn't want to listen to reason. It's a difficult thing to give up something that has supported your family for generations in ease and style and riches, and to let that all go because it's the moral or right thing to do. But they had to learn the hard way. The very thing that they were afraid I was going to do, march down there and free their slaves and ruin their economy, is exactly what they did to themselves in the course of the war.
You had mentioned that if the war had been short, that you would have not had the Emancipation Proclamation and that the country would basically go back to the state that it had been in. And it's my recollection that you had said at one point the Union was so important that you would do whatever it took to maintain it to avoid the Civil War. Is that right?
That was in a letter to Horace Greeley, who had been complaining about that we weren't making much progress in the war, and why didn't I free all the slaves with an executive order? So I wrote back a letter to him saying that what I do about the question of slavery, I do because it will save the Union. If I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves at once, I would do that. If I could save the Union by not freeing any of them, I would do that. If I could save it by freeing some and letting others be, I would do that. But what I do because I think it will save the Union.
And so eventually you did promulgate the Emancipation Proclamation. Tell us why you did that and what it actually accomplished.
Well, I was convinced by my cabinet and certain of the generals that the Southern forces were using the slave labor to support their army, to do the cooking and cleaning and digging trenches or whatever else they could get them to do. And this was freeing up soldiers to fight. And I thought, well, if we remove that source of labor through executive order, then that will cripple their ability to make war. So also, this proclamation of emancipation was a signal to the great European powers who depended on the Southern economy for their, Mr. Blake once called their dark satanic mills, the cotton mills. They needed the cotton. And if they decided to recognize the Confederacy, well, then we'd be in a heap of trouble. We'd have to fight all of Europe along with the Southern Confederacy. So this proclamation was a signal to them that this war was not about states' rights. It was about slavery, which most of the European countries had already gotten rid of. And then it would look like they were trying to support a slave economy, which went counter to their position as free men. So that was part of the reason for it. And again, to cripple their war effort. But I did not free all the slaves. I could not do that. I could only free those slaves who lived in states that were currently in rebellion. I couldn't free the slaves in Kentucky or Maryland or even Delaware because we needed those border states to support the Union cause. And if we'd included them, they might have gotten their dander up and went and joined the Confederacy just to hang on to their economy. So we had to be very careful of how we worded that document. It was an effort to raise morale among the abolitionists and people who believe we weren't doing enough about slavery and to cripple the Southern war effort. And we think it was successful as far as that was concerned.
Very interesting. And then your perhaps most famous speech is the Gettysburg Address. So can you explain the setting for that and why you think it's become so important in America?
Well, as of course everyone knows, the Battle of Gettysburg was a great and awful tragedy and loss of life. It was a victory for the Northern forces, and it prevented General Lee from further incursions into the Northern states. His plan was, he knew he couldn't win the war outright, but if he could frighten the North by invading, well, maybe they'll demand that we sue for peace and let them go back and live their own lives just as they were when they started. But the effort failed and left a huge amount of dead in Gettysburg. And there wasn't practical to be able to send all those soldiers' bodies back to their families, so they decided to initiate a cemetery there on the battlefield. And they made plans and arranged all the what they call logistics for a thing like that, and dug all the graves, and then figured it would be ready for opening and for visitors by November of that year. The battle had been in July. So they hired the best public speaker in the nation, the most famous speech maker, which was Edward Everett, who had a long career in politics and education, and he was going to give the keynote address. And they, as the date approached, they realized they really should have somebody from the federal government to, as they said, say a few appropriate words and then open the grounds. So they sent me a letter, would I be interested in coming and saying a few things after Mr. Everett's speech. And I thought, now here is an opportunity for me to explain what we've been doing and what this all means and what it means for the future of the country, why all this suffering was necessary. And I knew that whatever I said, as always, would be printed in the newspapers for people all over the country to read, so it would influence those who could not be there for the ceremony itself. And so I put a few ideas down and churned them until they coalesced into what I thought would be an effective little speech. People had been standing there for quite a long time, and they weren't up for much more speechifying. So Mr. Everett, on the day, he gave a two-hour speech where he described the battle and every aspect of it and all that happened on the 3 days. And then he sat down, and I stood up, and people didn't know what to expect. And my speech, as everyone knows, is only about 2 minutes long. And in it, I tried, as I said, to explain and to give people a sense of why it was so important that we continue our struggle to save this country, that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
Some say those are the, at least that speech is the most important and magnificent speech in American history, and some people even say world history. So thank you for that explanation. Then you came to the second inaugural.
Yes, I was fortunate enough to be elected again. I thought I was going to lose. I'd even produced a paper which I folded in half so they couldn't see what I wrote, and then I got all my cabinet to sign it. What it was a pledge on their part to support the incumbent president, whoever it may be, in ending the war before the inauguration of the new president, because he will have won the presidency under circumstances that would prevent his winning it after. He would have made too many promises to stop the war, and then we'd be right back where we started from. So fortunately, enough people realized that it's not a good idea to change horses in midstream, so I was elected on the strength of our continuing victories with Mr. Sherman going through Atlanta and Grant's victories in the South. People had more confidence and they voted for me, and then I had to make another speech. And this time it was pretty obvious that the war was going to end soon, and what I wanted to do was explain why it had lasted so long and what it meant for us in the future to have gone through all of this. And what I said, in effect, in the very end of the speech was that fondly do we hope and fervently do we pray that this mighty scourge of war may swiftly pass away. But if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled up by 250 years of the bondsman's unrequited toil shall be sunk, and every drop of blood drawn by the lash will be paid by one drawn by the sword, as it was said 3,000 years ago, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all that may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
Amazing words. The 13th Amendment. You did the Emancipation Proclamation as the president, as a war power measure, but eventually the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery across this country, including the border states. Tell us how you were able to accomplish that.
Well, as we came closer, I think, to victory, I realized that the Emancipation Proclamation was a fragile document. Legally, that once the war was over and the Southern states rejoined the Union, well, they could argue against it in court. It could be overturned in any of the states legally. So we decided we had to have something more effective and more permanent, and that meant an amendment to the Constitution itself, the law of the land it would be. So then we worked up the wording and of the what became the 13th Amendment, and we had to do a lot of fancy dancing among Congress to get them to support it, but eventually we were able to convince enough to vote in favor of it, and it eventually was ratified and became the law of the land. That meant there would be no more slavery of any kind in this country. Hope that eventually other countries would catch on and get rid of their institutions too, but some of them haven't done that yet.
Thank you for leading that monumental drive towards justice and equality and to constitutionalize it so it could not be taken away after the end of the war. We're about at the end of a very interesting couple of months later. An incident happened, but you're still here talking to me. So explain how you're here.
Well, I'm here in the same capacity that Mr. Shakespeare's Hamlet and King Lear are here, too. Long gone historically, but what they had to say was useful and important to people, make them feel things. And my presence, as I often explain to my audiences, is much like Mr. Shakespeare's quote in The Tempest, that we are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded by a sleep. So I tell my young audiences that for all I know, I'm back in my bed dreaming about you, or you're in your bed dreaming about me. Nobody knows for sure. The point is, I get to visit with you, which is very satisfying, and you get to visit with me, which I hope is educational for you, to learn a little bit about your own history. For it was Marcus Tullius Cicero from the Roman Empire who said that to be ignorant of what happened before you were born is to live forever as a child. So it's my hope that my life and experiences will inspire young audiences to learn more about their own history, their country's history, which is an epic story. It's not always a happy story. It doesn't always have happy endings. But it is what made our country what it is today, when it's right and when it's wrong. I call on them to do the patriotic thing by supporting their families and their neighbors and their communities, to support the country when it's in the right, and to call it to account when it's in the wrong. And that's your duty as a citizen. And I hope that it made an impression today.
The impression is amazing. So thank you. That's the understatement of the century. We very much appreciate you being here, Mr. President. It's been our honor and privilege. And God bless you and God bless America.
Thank you very well. And God bless you too, sir, your honor. And to all those who hear this, you have my encouragement and congratulations for keeping up the good work.
Some key takeaways from this episode. Abraham Lincoln grew up poor and began working with manual labor. Over time, he was able to educate himself and was elected to the Illinois legislature and then Congress for one term. Although he lost his bid for the U.S. Senate, he became a nationally recognized figure. Amazingly, he was nominated by the all but newly minted Republican Party and won his first election as president. He was a fierce advocate for maintaining the Union, as well as abolition, and eventually issued the Emancipation Proclamation as a wartime measure. He also led the drive for the adoption of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. He is a towering figure in helping America better fulfill its promise that all men are created equal. And his first inaugural address, the Gettysburg Address, and the second inaugural address are some of the most eloquent words uttered ever. I am Oakland County Circuit Court Judge Michael Warren and author of America's Survival Guide. This podcast is produced by Patriot Week. please visit Patriot Week's website at patriotweek.org to learn more about America's first principles, key documents and speeches, founding fathers and other great patriots, and flags from our history, along with all the other fantastic resources we have to offer. Our fellow patriots, thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless you and God bless America.
Thank you, our fellow patriots, for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast and rate us. That is, if you're going to give us those 5 golden stars. We can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and many other platforms. You can also find much more at patriotweek.org, which includes videos, lesson plans, TV episodes, and many other goodies. Patriot Week is celebrated every year from September 11th, the anniversary of the terrorist attacks, through September 17th, the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution. It has been recognized by the U.S. Senate and many states. Patriot Week was started by then 10-year-old Leah Warren when she pounded on the table and demanded a new celebration of America. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and on Instagram, or reach out directly at mwarren@patriotweek.org. Also consider Judge Warren's book, America's Survival Guide, How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles and History, by visiting americasurvivalguide.com, Amazon, or any other online retailer. Until next time, God bless you and God bless America.